Now, the shotgun start in golf is full of mathematics. There's a lot of setup work that we have to do in order to make a tournament work. So I'm going to demonstrate to you just exactly how we do a shotgun start here.
And here we go.
All right, all right, all right. Gentlemen, start your engine!
Greetings and welcome to a Monday edition of the Shotgun Start. It is November 30th. Andy, how we doing?
Brendan, I am doing wonderful. How are you?
I'm well. I'm doing well. Browns just won. It's a victory Monday. Bears are playing tonight. You said you're hopeful or optimistic about Mitch Trubisky, something like that.
Not really, but...
You sounded buoyant.
Who knows what's going to happen?
All right.
Peppy Peter.
Well, Peppy Andy, enthusiastic Andy. All right. Well, just as an order of business here, just to clarify, we had a Sunday episode, November 29th, that discussed the match, discussed what the strategic alliance between the PGA Tour, European Tour, more of our regular show. News of the day.
Just a bunch of news.
Order golf stuff of the day. So you talking about Dick Bland's finish in South Africa, things like that, you know, regular show. This Monday episode will be a spotlight on Mac O'Grady, Phil Megleno, a.k.a. Mac O'Grady, Philip McClelland O'Grady. Mac O'Grady, is he's most famously and infamously known.
HPP Fansworth, Wack O'Grady, Dial a Shot.
Dial a Shot. There's a lot of nicknames in there. So we will be doing, you know, one of the all-time characters. Maybe not, doesn't have the record or resume. We're not going to be doing the Hall of Fame debate at the end of this one like we would with Mark O'Mara, maybe.
He might belong in some sort of golf Hall of Fame. Maybe not for his play, but all-time personalities, he's first team, first ballot Hall of Famer.
And you never know. Maybe the Morehead Project, this five-work tome, will eventually see the light of day, and it will change the game forever, and he'll make the Hall of Fame for that. We don't know yet. Can't close the book on it, literally. So this spotlight is brought to you by Ruckit, our good friends at Ruckit. You know who they are. You know what they do. They've been riding with us now for a year, full year almost. They came on board here at Q4, bought up a couple extra spotlights.
They wanted to make these possible for you. They loved these, and they said, hey, we want you to do extra episodes where you neglect your family for days on end researching.
Neglect is the appropriate term. My wife is breathing down my neck here as we Sunday afternoon record this. But the two they ended up getting, Frank Stranahan and Mac O'Grady, I wonder if they thought they were buying the, you know, the irreverent sort of whack job series of this of the spotlights. But they are at ruckit.com/shotgunstart. We have our own URL now. That's where you go. You enter a contest, put your name, email in. You are then entered into a drawing for two at-home driving range setups, nets, mats, $208 value. And if you don't win, you automatically get a 20% off coupon courtesy of Ruckit. That's ruckit.com/shotgunstart. Now is the time to sort of be transitioning into whatever at-home setup, at-home practice, at-home, you know, sort of parlor game you want to set up. Now is the time to be doing that as the cold weather descends. And it's a good gift. It's a good gift to ask for. There you go. 20% off coupon. ruckit.com/shotgunstart. Thanks to them for sponsoring these spotlights.
Yeah, and the ongoing support of the show.
Yeah, seriously. They've been good. And you guys have showed up for them too as well. All right. Mac O'Grady, where do you want to start? There's so much to you were claiming you had more on him than Ernie Els, maybe. We got deep into it Saturday night reading up on him.
I had some Smith Devereaux, and I just was down in the basement reading tales of Mac O'Grady. There's all kinds of things to start. So, you know, just nuts and bolts of Mac O'Grady. Phil Megleno. He was born in Minneapolis, moved to L.A. when he was 10. He was the youngest of five boys. Mom died when he was 16. He had a kind of a tough upbringing. We'll get into all of that. He was a star athlete. He played quarterback on the football team, was a baseball player. He played golf at Rancho Park as well. You know, the nuts and the things you're going to hear all the time about Phil McGlennow, Mac O'Grady, he went to PGA Tour qualifying school 17 times, beginning in 1971, before eventually getting his card in 1982. In November of 1982. So he went to 17 times, and there's a long journey along the way, which we will get into shortly. But once he was on tour, he became quickly renowned as, you know, arguably the best ball striker, the best swinger of the golf club on the PGA Tour. He had, I mean, Johnny Miller called him dial-a-shot. Like, he could hit anything. Yeah. He could just, you know, there were tales of him being able to just hit it onto, like, sewer caps from 100 yards away. Like, just an unbelievable golf swing. Always struggled with the putter. Ambidextrous. He could play. He was a professional playing right-handed, but also a scratch playing left-handed. And another lore of Phil McGlennow, Mac O'Grady, is that he attempted and petitioned for his amateur status as a lefty. He wanted to play in amateur tournaments as a left-hander.
Also wanted to play at two-man events. Tried to get into the Chrysler in Michigan. So he wanted to enter as righty and lefty. So he would be the two-man team himself, playing both righty and lefty. You know, he's got a number... like. Look, it's crazy enough. He swung from tee to green one way, you know, with right hand, then gets up and puts left-handed. You know, that's pretty intense. But just attempting to play these two-man tournaments as himself, professionally, both righty and lefty, attempting to play as an amateur at events as a lefty, it's kind of astounding. And, you know, like, his left-handed swing was thought to be a model, almost like a mirror image, right? I think Azinger and one of them, your guy Azinger, was like just sort of captivated by it, like could not believe how mirror images they were, like, when he flipped over and started swinging.
Yeah, you know, he retired early because of a back injury, a spinal disorder. I'm not even going to try and pronounce it. The word is so long, that the condition. He had to retire because of that, but then he figured out quickly that it didn't hurt to swing left-handed. So then he attempted to come back as a lefty, and he actually attempted to, you know, enter a PGA Tour tournament, but he wanted to enter under Mac O'Grady II. Because he said he was a new golfer as a lefty. So, but they wouldn't give him his past status as the second, so he dropped it and entered as Mac O'Grady the first, you know, or senior.
Right. There's all sorts of he allegedly hit a 290 in the air swinging righty, but 270 lefty. The one club he set the course record both, you know, as a righty, and the shot, what, like 62 as a righty, and then came back like a week later, shot 65 as a lefty. So he was truly, you know, I think a lot of professional golfers can be pretty adequate from their opposite side, right? A lot of them they're just really exceptional athletes and skilled in that way. But I mean, he's setting course records from both sides. His was another level, and I think a lot of it sort of originates with this devotion to every aspect of the swing, right? Almost a man, like an obsessive devotion and trying to understand it. You know, there was a lot of it based in the golfing machine and mechanical and scientific approaches. But
lots of common words with Bryson.
There's a lot of different, overlaps with words. Like Shanahan talking about being 120, 130 and getting thick. This is a little bit on the science side with the overlaps of Bryson, and really, I don't know, your mouth starting to run and using a lot of big words and maybe it not always coming out legibly, intelligibly. So
he won twice on tour. He won the 1986 Greater Hartford Open, and then he won the subsequent 87 Tournament of Champions. So
LaCosta. the TOC, La Costa.
Some legit wins.
And barely. We'll get into that. Barely.
Barely.
The soft greens almost sent his putter yips off into the in the ocean. Soft greens did not kind of put his brain on the fritz.
Before his win in 86, I saw a quote of like, I haven't won anything since like the early 70s in junior golf days.
Since he was a, never won. That's the thing. He was like, you know, the Johnny Miller in awe, saying he could dial up, he can do anything. But like, he didn't win. He never won. And most of it attributable to that whole putting thing. You know, he putted left-handed. Many people saw that as a sign of his, you know, he can't putt, right? If you guys flipping from righty to lefty, there's a reason for it. And you know, he still wasn't great when he was hitting left, putting left.
You know, he it was a short career, so he's full time on tour from 83 to 89. But his star burned bright then. He was a fan favorite. They loved him.
Well, yes, yes. I mean, some of it has to do with the rebellious nature. I mean, he called the commissioner. Called the commissioner Hitler, or made drew a comparison with Hitler,
a thief. Later, a thief I watched with capital with T.
Dean Beeman. Now, I watched an interview with Roy Firestone where he was clear to point out that the Beeman to Hitler comparison was more on the totalitarianism front, not the mass murdering thing. You know, the whole genocide. Wanted to clarify that in the TV interview. So yeah, that kind of led to maybe a little bit of his popularity, the whole rebelling against the rules and authority and all that stuff. So
all right, should we dive in?
Yeah, let's dive in.
So he's born this family, rough family.
Rough.
Brothers get arrested at a young age. When he's a young age, they beat him. I saw an interview with his older brother where he talked about they hit Phil. They, you know, it was not an easy upbringing for Mr. McGlennow. But all the while, he becomes like addicted to sports, and he becomes a, you know, just kind of a legend around the neighborhood in L.A. He's a great athlete. He plays his first round of golf at Rancho Park, pitch and putt, which is still there. Wonderful place to go. You know, if you're into smoking weed, go smoke some weed and play the pitch and putt. That's what most of the regulars there do.
Really?
It'll take you about 6 hours to play nine holes, but, you know, it's not about the golf. But anyways, McGlennow, he made a hole one this first round. But with two mulligans.
It was a five. Yeah, right. Okay. First round ever, though. It's still pretty impressive.
And I just would like to put out there, there's going to be a ton of source material. There are two wonderful profile pieces. One, an SI feature from Steve Wolf, and then a Golf Digest feature from... Kevin Cook.
Late 90s is published in Digest at that point. 98, I want to say. And Kevin Cook is republished recently as part of Digest anniversary.
Now, important to note, O'Grady put a media embargo on all media after the SI piece.
And Steve Wolf, 1984. Steve Wolf. He's the guy that pissed off MJ, right? That MJ said he would never talk to Sports Illustrated again. Of course, that was more of the headline, right? The Baggett Michael, right? When he was playing baseball. And that was infamously why, you know, Michael Jordan never talked to Sports Illustrated again.
So he put an embargo on media after that. And then he was irate, called Golf Digest numerous times, refuting every aspect of the Golf Digest article.
There's a lot of that. Just, I mean, things happen. He says they don't happen, right? Or like he's always quarreling about how something was portrayed, or how, you know, or outright contesting the veracity of things.
In general, he's a walking controversy.
Yeah. Right. But not a big fan of talking to the media, and still to this day is sort of recluse and hard to find. You have anything else on his early life? Yeah. I think the big thing. So it's you're talking about a walking controversy, the quarrelsome, like the origin story of it is like he comes from a rough background, right? Where it's probably going to be hard to trust. It'd be hard to like, you know, they're hard to kind of take authority with, you know, sitting down. You know, got the crap kicked out of him. He was youngest of five boys, had a twin sister, had another sister. You know, he talks about his brothers are all into drugs, drug dealers. You know, the one ran into a police car with thousands of dollars worth of drugs, crashed into a police car. They went to prison. One died. He said drugs had to. So he comes from little. And his dad, he had no relationship with his dad. His dad, you know, it claims, you know, he hit his kids. That's in the Kevin Cook article. And violence, you know, trickled down to all the other brothers. So it comes from, he had this really strong connection to his mom, right? This devotion to his mom, Patricia, which is why he loved Rancho so much, because it was on Patricia Avenue is the name of the name of the street where Rancho is. And that's where he made his pro debut, a PGA Tour debut when he got his card. But his mom passed away from an aneurysm suddenly when he was 16 and in high school. So like just a rough go of it really early on. They lived in like a cramped apartment. His dad worked for Hughes Aircraft, I want to say. It was just, it was a tough upbringing.
Did you see the thing about his running when he was young?
Yeah, he would run. He would just kind of like, I mean, you're getting out of this apartment, he would just run forever, right? Yeah. He didn't have my knees, I guess. He would run like 14 miles up and down to Santa Monica back. One time he ran like 110 miles. He just ran to San Diego, right?
Yeah. They said he was the original crazed jogger of Southern California.
And then Rancho, I love the images of him in Rancho. Gary McCord was like a young Southern California, another kind of odd job, right? An oddball. And they were sort of found companionship in that. And he talks about the images of Mugleno, then Phil Mugleno, showing up in short shorts, a tank top, and a cowboy hat. And that's how he would play all the time at Rancho.
So. Yeah. So Mugleno turns pro at age 17. Or actually okay. 20. At 20.
He 1971. Did a spell, what, like Santa Monica Junior College, but that was it. Yeah. Just for like a spell. So never really had a home. I mean, let's put it that way. Go ahead.
So this guy, Walter Kelly, McKellar, who's a golf shop owner and patriarch of amateur golf in LA, he got a group of wealthy investors together from Riviera and Bel Air to sponsor him.
Yep.
So he had been caddying for these guys at the clubs, you know, since he was young, and you know, they kind of, you know, put this money together because this guy was so talented. You know, everybody looked right at him like this guy's going to be the next superstar on tour. You know, this was the first real big relationship that soured on Mac. So
yeah, the Keller guy, he had some weight, right? Yeah. Like he had the connections with Bel Air, Riviera. I think he just taught Amy Alcott, kind of got her off into the pro ranks, and like could have paved the way. I think he ended up getting him a junior membership at Riv at one point. Like pulled some weight in LA to get him going.
I think Dean Martin was one of his investors, maybe.
Yeah, I want to say like Glenn Campbell, like there's been a lot of guys that tried to back him and then it went bad. But yeah, there were a couple famous Riviera entertainment types that backed him too.
So
in his early 20s.
O'Grady got wrapped up in this mistaken identity, like in a theft case, but his identity was mistaken. So, you know, the charges were all dropped eventually, but then O'Grady countersued, and one of the guys was Keller's buddy.
Yeah. This is, again, like leads to a lot of like the later life sort of rebellion and the fines from Dean Beeman that he contested all the way to the end. Like he was mistakenly arrested for theft in 1969, countersues, blows up a lot of that kind of rich guy network with this, right? Yeah. With the countersuit against like the rich guy LA network that was willing to back him.
And at this point, so then, you know, he loses his investors, but also it alienates him. He can't play at Bel Air, Riviera, or LACC. He like then at this point has to just play wherever, you know? He lost, you know, and he had a few people that would let him go play there. Lakeside would let him play the pro there. He claimed that Keller asked him to fail.
Right, because what? they didn't want to have to pay for him to actually make it on tour. Yeah. They just would rather wash out.
He said, this is O'Grady's quote. He was afraid I would succeed and that his group would be bound to sponsor me. I was incarcerated in a pool of avaricious sharks.
Avaricious sharks.
Avaricious sharks.
I mean, that's the whole thing. In so many of these articles are just like, you let him go. You wind him up and let him go because he was an avid reader and then just would find some words and start, you know, repurposing those words in a Bryson way, almost terminal velocity type way. So often. Huh. Continue.
He gets really sick at 22. And at that point, he becomes obsessed with golf. And he estimated that he had, obsessed with books. And at this point, he estimated that he had about a fourth grade reading comprehension. But then he just started devouring books. And it became like a staple. It was like he would travel with a bag of golf clubs and a bag of books.
Yeah, and the books would be like the thesaurus, the dictionary. And then, like, of course, the poetry books and things like that. He was kind of a voracious reader there. And that's... where all these kind of big words in every interview and every book and every article, followed thereafter.
Mm-hmm. So he bumps into these guys, Raphael Shapiro and Bob McClelland.
McClelland, yeah, yep. Yep, who we take his name, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's
part of why he became Mac O'Grady. The O'Grady, we should say, it's his mom's maiden name. The mom that he, you know, really loved and had a strong relationship and obviously didn't have a great one with his dad. But the McClellan that became Mac was just a buddy, right? A guy, sort of a backer, an investor, a confidant, guy who gave him work, too, when he needed work.
So he estimated that they spent about $250,000 on him over this journey for him to get to, you know, the PGA Tour. McClelland eventually like bowed out of sponsoring him and that relationship soured a little bit and that really hurt him, he felt like. Yeah. But like you see every single relationship he has, except for with the exception of his eventual wife, sours. Shapiro owned a restaurant and he would work there in all different aspects. Chef.
Owned a restaurant in Palm Springs, too. I like that guy's name, Raphael Shapiro.
Yeah.
You see why he's like an Italian. It has an Italian restaurant, but he renamed it. He took the last name Shapiro because he said he's always felt like Jewish or felt like kinship with the Jewish faith. Just changed his name. All these guys he's running with, Mac O'Grady changed his name. Raphael Shapiro was named like Raphael Viscusi or something like that. So, and that's where, you know, Mac would work as a dishwasher, busboy, and sort of became this, I don't know, protege, or at least they had a strong relationship. Shapiro would give him advice and back him, obviously, financially.
So. He played the Asian Tour in 77, finished 30th on the money list, but then he missed, again, the tour qualifying. And he says that at that point, his game fell apart, completely fell apart. So I think I was trying to copy Nicholas's swing, but I couldn't hit the ball 200 yards. I thought my golf career was over. So this gets us to November of 77, and McClelland has nowhere to go. So he has like no home, no money.
It's kind of incredible, right?
Yeah, insane.
I mean, he turns pro. He's got this network of LA rich guys and pros that want to help him. Of course, he kind of burns those bridges, whether by his own actions and temperament or not. You know, he does a little Euro tour, a little Asian tour, rides his bike. Like, you know, he's riding his bike everywhere. He's jogging everywhere. He's going to Q school like all the time, right? He takes these Greyhound bus to Florida because they weren't in California then. It was Texas and Florida. And he failed 16 times in 10 years. So it was multiple. It wasn't like the one shot deal where, you know, a lot of us in our 30s are used to just once a year.
He said if there were more, he would have failed more times. You know, he would have just kept signing up and failing.
Doing these odd jobs, right? I mean, he's working in like mechanical with the McClellans, like mechanical shop. He's working at the restaurant. I love the one where he worked at the Westwood Memorial Park and Mortuary. And you put on a suit and pick up the Dear Departed with, and but on the they like hit wiffle golf balls around the cemetery at night and play football at the cemetery at night. It's kind of amazing. And then November of 77. So he's
this is from the SI.
He's got nowhere to go.
This is from the SI piece. So one night he broke into an empty mansion by the 17th hole at Bel Air. He stayed there for a month, like a cockroach, he says, slipping away on his bicycle at dawn and returning after nightfall. He would spend his days at the little pitch and putt course at Holmby Park, which is still there. One morning he overslept in the mansion and was nearly caught by the real estate agent showing the place. For a few weeks, McGlenno lived surreptitiously
in a Malibu beach cottage
until
he again barely escaped detection. Kind of nuts.
So,
right?
Yeah. And that, so then there was a torrential downpour one night in Malibu. McGlenno took cover in the garage of an apartment house in West LA. On the platform above one of the cars, he noticed a plywood box, a 10-foot by 4-foot by 5-foot, used to store beach furniture and other large items. He moved in, bike and all, and stayed there for a couple months, reading by battery lamp and subsisting on peanut butter sandwiches. The Japanese have a word for a box like that. They call it a hako. If I ever form a corporation, I'll call it Hako Incorporated. Unbelievable.
This is now mentioned in every article, every profile written thereafter. It's like the guy who lived in a storage box for a portion of his life in a garage in West LA. I mean, this is really, I think, where he got really into reading,
yes,
right? Like just he's got his bike in a storage box and a battery lit lamp and a ton of books.
And peanut butter.
That's what he does. And peanut butter.
And this is when he meets his wife, too.
Living in L.A., living in Bel Air on some mansion, then a Malibu beach house, and then a box. It's unbelievable. So how do you meet his wife? At Rancho, right? On the first tee at Rancho for an LPGA event?
Mm-hmm.
Fumiko, yeah.
They go on a date. He's immediately in love, you know. And, you know, from there, he got really sick again. And then
she was the one that nursed him back, right?
Yeah.
He showed up on her doorstep, like, really sick. And she, you know, they had met and been on a few dates then. And she, like, he just starts living with her for a year as she nurses him back to health.
His hako didn't have the necessary supplies for his sickness.
I guess so. And then 78, he changes his name to Mac O'Grady, right? So that's the year after. You know, he's living in a storage cabinet or storage box in a garage. He changes to Mac O'Grady.
And he felt like he was throwing away all the past. You know, he's a new man with his new name. You know, he's very believing of that. And he gets serious at this point about left-handed golf. And he starts taking lessons from Sherry Wilder, a pro in Palm Springs. And after a month and a half, he shot 68 lefty. But he still felt more comfortable swinging righty. So this is how he got putting lefty, swinging righty.
Yep. 79. So he's already like really, you know, he's pretty accomplished, right? I mean, not accomplished, I shouldn't say. Talented, right? Incredibly talented. Really understands, obsessed with the golf swing. 79, I don't know. They characterize this as a turning point in his life, right? He discovers Homer Kelly's book, The Golfing Machine. You know, we've talked about this with Clampett, right? The Clampett flashlight or whatever that was way back when in March or April, whenever we did that.
Bryson's alluded to it.
The book breaks the swing down into 24 components and 144 variations. Now, you know, O'Grady's Morad system, which we'll talk about later, I think has 182,900 apparently he knows every single one of them. It just multiplies. There are 13 points and 4 phases. It just starts to add up. And there's 182,000 variables, which apparently he knows them all. So he gets deep into the golfing machine in 1979. You know, the first time I tried to read the book, I threw it down the stairs. I didn't even know what a 90-degree angle was. Fumiko, his wife, told me, "You must go see this man. then it will be a guided struggle, not a blind struggle. And so Grady spoke with Kelly by phone, raining up thousands of dollars in long distance calls, and finally flew up to Seattle, spent a couple days with them, and like Kelly like felt like he'd finally found like the ideal sort of pupil for this golfing machine. And you know, it became sort of his complete obsession with how he approached the golf swing. 81, he married Fumiko.
80 is when McClellan broke up with him.
Oh, what happened there? What? I mean, all these relationships blow up after a while, except with Fumiko.
And with Homer Kelly.
So
yeah.
He died.
McClellan.
Had he lived longer, there would have been a breakup there, I'm sure. Right?
Yeah. According to O'Grady, McClellan wrote O'Grady off. He told me I'd been the biggest disappointment of his life. You're such a good player, but you're never going to be great. He asked me not to come to the factory anymore. He was hurt, but I was no longer the feeble-minded child. I said, I disagree with you. I only wish I had changed my name to Raphael O'Grady.
So in honor of Shapiro instead of McClellan.
Yes.
The restaurateur who stayed friends with them until later. So the guy he named himself after no longer was a friend. 81, he marries Fumiko in Osaka, or near Osaka. But this was, now he's on his 16th try at Q School. Just, I mean, we're talking 1981. He's been a pro for, what, 10 years now? He led he led Q School after 36 holes, and then he shot back-to-back 80s in Texas and missed it by 4 strokes.
He was not happy riding the Greyhound bus back.
That's the other thing. There's the images of him, like, those bus rides back, right? He takes the bus from California to Texas or Florida every time, and it's like, all right, the 14th time I failed to get out of Q School, the 15th, you know, all these, like, what he associates more with those failures are, like, the notes and the mental anguish of riding the Greyhound bus back to off in California.
All right, 82, he plays on the European Tour, and he gets lucky number 17, Q School. Now, the great thing about this is
that Euro Tour, he played 27 straight tournaments. Did you see that? You go from Tunisia to Sweden to Scotland, and that's where I learned how to play on different grasses. Here's a quote that you'll take with. In different weather and in different weather conditions. That's what got me ready for the Q School tournament, which we eventually got through. That's what taught me, quote, every dimension of nature's womb. So playing all over 27 straight weeks on European Tour is how he learned every dimension of nature's womb, he said. All right, so the Q School.
Now, it's great. He wrote in his journal every night after each of his rounds. So we'll alternate. I'll read one, you read the next one.
Oh, I don't have them all. You read. I got... Go ahead.
All right.
Go ahead.
Tuesday, first round, I scored a 79, 7 over par. I rein in an unprecedented 180th position out of a starting field of 200. I'm in pain now. Somewhat shocked and numb from this opening round, but certainly not despairful. Should I control the ever-perplexing variables of swing mechanics, I believe success will be ours before the gun lap of this event has been completed. They say patience is a virtue. As I lay in room number 166 of the Incana Lodge on Phillips Highway in Jacksonville, I hope for my sake the cool, collective aura of patience will guide me into successful harbors. I believe. Wednesday, second round, I scored 76, 4 over par. The end result continues to indicate I'm not making the grade. I'm sounding depressed. I'd better stop writing. I'm afraid I may write something that will convince me I won't qualify at week's end. Thursday, third round. Well, old feeble-minded Big Mac is no longer a French fry. Big Mac shot an under par round of 71 at the TPC to move into 144th position in this tormenting event. I feel better, tranquil somewhat, but I'm still in the doghouse. Where is Cinderella's other shoe?
All right, I got Friday. I'll give you a break here. Friday, fourth round. Can you believe it? I shot a 66, 6 under par at Sawgrass and tied the course record. I flew right into 24th position. What a brilliantly executed exaltation of professional judgment, mechanical precision, and psychological execution of poise, courage, and artistic unraveling. Peace reigns over my emotions. The torch of adversity has burned hard and long against my skin for nearly one decade now. It's been a remarkable day, one that will thrill me in my grandpa years ahead. Good night, all. Big Mac is ready for slumber. So his mood is changing. He shot a 66. He's been a decade and 16 failures at Q school. I don't have Saturday.
Saturday, yeah, fifth Saturday. Round. The comeback from poverty to riches is taking place before my eyes. I scored a 71 today, the third straight under par round for the kid of Los Angeles. My ranking is 10th place. The question remains, can Big Mac find the golden arches? We'll learn tomorrow.
Really a lot of McDonald's. When did all those McDonald's analogies come in? Go ahead. A lot of McDonald's references.
Sunday, sixth round. It's all over. Big Mac is in the big, big leagues. It's been a lifelong dream to make it to the majors. Bring out the fruit juices. It's time to celebrate this victorious parade that has taken over one decade to complete. I scored a 73 today. My final ranking was fourth place. A few moments ago, I called Fumiko in Japan to inform her of the long-awaited good news. When she answered the telephone, I couldn't speak. I was crying.
So it's 10 years, 16 tries, probably record, right? I mean, I'm not sure that will... Has anyone approached that? I don't think that's the case. They said they thought it would be, you know, a record in terms of persistence and failure and persistence and failure and persistence.
I think the 17 times is pretty unbelievable. You know, maybe more so than the years.
He talks about the fourth day. This was Dave Anderson, legendary New York Times writer. He had a good story in addition to the Steve Wolf and the Kevin Cook ones. He's like, the fourth day at Sawgrass, the weather changed and like it was blowing 30 miles an hour. He thought like his year in Europe before then like had really helped him. And that's when he shot 66 when nobody else broke 75. And he went from 144th to 24, which he called the greatest jump in the history of golf. So
he was Ken Duke before Ken Duke.
I love the, so this is also from Dave Anderson, Sunday. Like, he's just hanging on. Like, there have been the times, like the year before, right? He led, and then he shot 80-80 on back-to-back days. He talks about how he's had many deaths. And, you know, he holed it out of a bunker for birdie on 8. He sank a 10-footer for par. He birdied 13, 14, 15, 16, and 17. The one with the green in the middle of a lake. Where Chainsmokers now are infamously give concerts. On the 18th tee, he said, I decided to hit a one iron to play it safe. Keep it away from the big lake on the left, but I hit it straight into a big bush. I had flashbacks to the European Tour trying to qualify for the British Open. I hit my ball into a pop bunker and I hit it 16 times in there before I decided to walk off. One of my many deaths. On the first hole of the European Championships at Sunningdale, I took a 14, another death. And now here I was in the bush. It's his last hole of this arduous, 144 holes. I was in the bush. I barely got out, but I saved a double bogey for a 71.
Or 73. You know. Wow.
Yeah. So I thought that was like...
Do you have the McCord story?
No, I don't think so.
So McCord earned his tour card the same day.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So... I had a few cocktails that night, says McCord. This is from the Digest article, the Cook article. Yeah. I asked Mac to come along, but he said he had something to do. That evening, O'Grady carried 16 baseball bats onto the TPC course. On each one, written in magic marker, was the date and site of all 16 of his Q school failures. Mac took aim at a tree and proceeded to swing full force at the tree until each bat was shattered.
Anderson had this too. He says he got him at a sporting goods store on his way home that day and just writes in magic marker. He goes, by the 10th or 11th bat, my arms were aching and I was crying again. Just smashing these bats against a tree. Should note, he never drank, never smoked. You know, talk about McCord going out for drinks and what in his journal, he goes, it's time to break out the fruit juices or something like that. Like he doesn't drink, never smoked, anything like that. It's interesting. I think the Wolf article talked about even now, neither Fumiko nor Matt can talk about that day without tears. Like, so, you know, I think we just saw DJ, you know, like break down at the Masters. Like, so many of these moments happen right at major championships, or I don't know, it's a Ryder Cup or something like that, or it's a first win, or it's a win after 10-year drought, you know, Jim Herman or something like that. For O'Grady, it really is this just getting it, just getting through Q school is the career kind of pinnacle, career achievement, whatever happened. I think winning even majors after that, having 10 years and 16 failures in those 10 years, it really feels like that 17th Q school was always going to be the most meaningful moment of his professional golf playing career, at least. Because talks about they can still not talk about that day without tears, his wife, to find out you are right. Right to believe in those dreams. Nothing in life could be as sweet as that.
Yeah, so. In his first year on tour, something that kind of resonated with me, he said, I've played so many places around the world during the last 10 years or so. Being on the PGA Tour is like celebrating Christmas every day.
Yeah, it was just getting there became the sort of career achievement. So I think he had a great... he had a great quote about, you know, you measure one. He said it was from a philosopher. He gave it to Anderson. I'm trying to find it right now. Is what he capped his story with. It's like the pain. You can measure one's happiness. When he hasn't won on the PGA Tour event yet, but he knows he will. And here's what he said. And when I do, I'm going to go back to the Q school and tell all those guys that your happiness in life is measured by how deep sorrow has cut within you. I mean, that's like a real, he said he got it from a philosopher, but he used it again for the story. I'm going to go back to Q school and tell those guys that your happiness in life is measured by how deep sorrow has cut within you. And he gave that on his first year on tour to Dave Anderson.
I think this ties actually to DJ winning and being so teared up is like, that wouldn't have been such an emotional win for DJ had he not had so many major championships, like, you know, just blow up in his face. Right. Like that, right. That's what makes it mean more. It's like when you just kind of like glide your way in and win right away, it doesn't mean as much as them when you struggle along the way to get there.
Yeah. Yep.
All right. Should we talk about making his tour debut?
Yeah. Yeah. So Homer Kelly, by the way, died 83, right? Mm-hmm. His first full year on tour, you know, so that was kind of a big blow. But yeah, his first year, he gets out on tour. He doesn't want to play the first event, right? Mm-hmm. I think it was a Tucson Open with his card, because the next event is the LA Open at Rancho, because Riviera's having the PGA,
yeah.
83. So he decides to play at Rancho.
Patricia Lane.
Yeah, the sentimentality of like you guys don't even understand like the meaning behind all this, you know, Shapiro would tell us. But go ahead, his first year.
See, he played great.
He opens with four straight birdies, right?
Yeah, he opens with four straight birdies, plays a great round. I think he shot 67. I don't have it written down.
Might have been 66, something like that.
He runs into his friend, John Hayes, who is the pro at Lakeside. And... who let him play all the time, and he died later that day.
Yeah, he talks about how this kind of threw him off for the rest of the tournament or the rest of the Open.
I imagine it would. It was like, yeah. You know, like this guy, it was the guy that welcomed his arms when and that he died on the golf course.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Grady kind of portrays it as like they literally took a fork in the road or the golf course. You know, O'Grady went one way. Hayes must have gone another way and passed away. Died from a heart attack at the tournament. And O'Grady had been playing well in his first pro event and kind of, you know, receded certainly after that. What else about his first year?
Homer, you know what I mean? Kelly dies. His quote is, yep. It was a few weeks after the LA Open. For 20 years, I had been marooned on an island of ignorance. That book got the clay out of my ears and lifted the veil from my eyes.
His best finish was a tie for third at the Heritage And it's, I love Marooned on an Island of Ignorance. There's a lot of them that are like that. Marooned on an Island of Ignorance is a good
all-time
one.
Quote. I might have to use that at some point.
Nature's Womb, you should get that one in your arsenal as well. His best finish his first year was a third, tied for third at the Heritage, Hilton Head, which he led after through two rounds. But that was also where he first entered the national spotlight.
Yes.
Did you get this?
I CBS, love this.
Which was televising the tournament, fell in love with O'Grady. At one point, he called over a cameraman who was following him. At first, the cameraman thought he was going to be chastised for getting in O'Grady's way, but Max said, "I want you to know, you can get as close as you want. You can take shots in front of my nose, between my legs, whatever you want to do. People should know my story of perseverance and how it's steeped in the American traditions of freedom and justice handed down by Franklin and Jefferson." I mean, that's like Bryson invoking, you know, Newton and George Washington and things like that. I mean, it's an incredible story of perseverance, right? 16 times Q school, living in a garage box and all that. But like,
well, I will say this quote kind of leads his... He really believed in his freedom with his fight with Beeman.
I know.
It kind of like is a foreboding.
Yeah. Yeah.
Did you see this?
Yeah, freedom of speech, freedom of, you know, Beeman being used as a totalitarian figure and all that stuff. But go ahead.
He keeps his card. He has a decent first year on tour. But did you see that he was his perpetual search for the perfect caddy?
Yes. Yes.
He told Golf Magazine that he would welcome applications from qualified convicts because he says he feels an identification with those kinds of guys who've had it tough. He was besieged with inquiries. One hopeful wrote, "I will be leaving the pen in February and would love to go to work for you. I have played golf for 8 years and can shoot in the high 70s. I was a farmer for 10 years, so I'm plenty strong enough to carry your bag. I could read the greens on the worst of courses. Thank you, Sid. Ex-con. P.S. Having an ex-con carrying your bag will draw as many people to the tournament as Jack N. Jack Nicklaus. O'Grady was tempted, but PGA officials discouraged the idea."
I hate that that was another thing that made him sort of famous or drew the national spotlight. It was this call for ex-cons to apply to be his caddy. Did you see the one that caddy had in Hawaii?
Oda,
kid?
Yeah.
Oda? Yeah. Is this John Oda's dad?
I looked it up. It was Jeff. I think his name was Jeff Oda. I was Googling, Jeff trying Oda. To figure out if it was a relative. But then he had a Dr. Oda that was trying to help him with his back and Hawaii. I wonder if he chose him because of his last name.
So he's getting rid of caddies left and right. There's one, even in the Steve Wolf one, he talks
fired
about the caddy had hired him. Yeah, he's like, "I like this caddy, Kevin. He calms me down." But then he fired him like the next week. Jeff Oda
said he was holding him back. Japanese. Said he was holding him back as negativity.
He runs through a lot of caddies. Jeff Oda was a half Irish, half Japanese, perfect match for Mac. Unfortunately, Oda was only 13 years old. His perfect match. O'Grady loved him. "I was nearly 20 years older, but I was in total awe of him," says O'Grady. "He would say, 1 inch to the right, slightly downhill, and walk away. He had such courage of his convictions. One time, though, he said, this is the best, could go left, could go right, could go straight, and walked away." And O'Grady says he broke up laughing. He had his best showing of the year in Hawaii. Finished tied for third and made 13th and made $8,000. So yeah, the caddy thing was a great sort of quirk.
Did you see the stuff about agents?
No, he just never wanted an agent, right? Because they thought he'd parade him around like a circus act.
Yeah.
And they, you know.
So like agents were like trying to line up because this guy is so marketable. Like, you know, people love this guy. They're lining up. So he said, this is his quote. "I'm afraid they would have turned me into a freak show. Step right up, see the man who plays with both hands and went through the qualifying school 17 times. Never signed with an agent. He refused all endorsements and took no money from his students." So he becomes this renowned teacher while he's on tour. Like Gene Littler's going to see him. Like all these like famous golfers, he becomes Seve's coach. Like And he's on tour. Half the time he's playing, half the time he's giving lessons. But, you know, there's this group of golfers that believe that Mac O'Grady is a genius.
Knows the swing better than, you know, has a rightful claim. I mean, I don't think it's a crazy claim that to say he knows the swing better than anyone else in the world. I love the story of, you talk about Littler. Apparently he was on the range and O'Grady was spinning him around in like a desk, office desk chair, trying to show him centrifugal force. And I don't know, somebody's like, you walk out there, there's this nut spinning Gene Littler around in a desk chair. And Seve, I think he stayed. Seve was the longest coach Seve ever had. I think had O'Grady work with them for like 8 or 9 years or something. They broke up.
It was O'Grady's best friend. Friend on tour. Yeah. Seve was.
Yeah, yeah. That failed. You know, blew up spectacularly as all O'Grady relationships. It said something about like he's more neurotic than I am. I found a Brandel article kind of ripping Mac. Is teaching, saying like actually Seve got worse under O'Grady, like the shot making, the dial a shot is sort of myth making and not true and all that stuff. But anyways, he's trying to do all this stuff. He's playing while also more or less teaching.
Brandel throwing stones.
Couple other things on the wall. Go ahead.
Well, once he got, so he's on tour, and once he got to tour, he had one last dream. And he'd be on the last fairway, last hole at the U.S. Open, and O'Grady would have a lead that's comfortable enough for him to hit his last drive left-handed. He would spin his driver around and hit it. He'd, you know, hit it left-handed upside down and hit it like 250 in the air.
That's what's the claim. Yeah, he spins the back, so it's the back of the driver, right? Or it's like inverted.
Yeah.
And he swings left-handed. That was his dream, the 18th hole of the U.S. Open, the national championship, and hitting it left-handed. Can I just say a couple other things from the Steve Wolf profile while we're sort of in deep in this one right now? Like, this is the ultimate assignment because it's the Bing Crosby. He's walking Cypress Point, listening to Mac O'Grady talk golf and just use all these. We recommend, obviously, read the article. He's like, just hole by hole.
Just wavering
anytime
too.
You talk, yeah, bogey, double bogey. You know, 16, I think he made an 8 or something like that. He's like, this is the greatest hole in the world. I'd be happy to play this every day.
Yeah, but by the end of the round, he said he never wanted to play the course again.
Yes, this O'Grady hit his tee shot in the rocks and ended up with a double bogey, quote, right into the devil's mouth. It's an honor to play this hole, the number one hole on tour. Fear personified. If I hit 20 balls into the water on 16 at Cypress, I can still stroll down the fairway in perfect serenity. Anytime you talk with them, you'll hear three words you never heard before, says fellow pro Mike Nicolette. O'Grady is liable to babble on, hooking words out of bounds, slicing the language into the trees, but he says things with such abandon that he will stop every once in a while to laugh at himself. So, like, he knows there's a little bit of it, like, he can get carried away. The terminal velocity thing or a little. He used proprioception a lot, which is a Bryson favorite. And then, you know, this Wolf, he's just narrating him. He's walking Cypress with him. And the Bing Crosby, as he's shooting, like, 80 or something with Willie McCovey as his celebrity partner. You know, on the front side, he pars the first. Second, he resumes his commentary. If I was 100 years old and shooting 150, I'd come back here every day and play. He bogeys the third. He just weaves in the bogeys. I feel like a Saturn V rocket going into geosynchronous orbit. He bogeys the fourth. I'm going through a catatonic, neurosomatic, emotional disorder right now. I'm in total emotional upheaval. Walking down the eighth fairway, he tries to lift up his spirits. The Japanese have a wonderful expression about golf. They say the reason you play badly is because you won't let yourself play badly. I still don't follow that. If you're afraid to play badly, when the time comes for you to play well, you won't let yourself play well. That's one of the reasons I haven't signed any contracts. I would be so upset right now. I do feel dilapidated, though. He finished with an 80. I'm in an amentisaceous state, bewildered, confused. Do you remember all that Romeo and Juliet, Hearts and Flowers stuff about how I love to play this course every day, even if I shot 150? Do you recall all those romantic things I said? Forget them. I never want to play this course again. And he laughs. So it's like this is who he was when he was talking to the press. Now, Steve Wolf writes all this up and, you know, he gets furious and says, you know, this is a total misrepresentation. This is not who I am. Like, I never want to talk to you again, kind of thing. All right. That was a 1984. So start of his second full year that that feature came out on tour.
In 84, he had drafted a letter to NASA volunteering his services to the space program.
And he wanted to, the media guide, he wanted to list a special interest as molecular biology, but his request was made too late for the media guide. What's the letter to NASA? I'm here if you need me.
Yeah, it was basically like, I'm here to help.
One quote I saw in like four or five articles, like everybody took this one. It became part of like the Mac O'Grady sort of biography. A wedge shot isn't just a wedge shot, but, quote, a bird flying to the firmaments, outlined against an incandescent sky, beginning to fall, gently sashaying back to Earth. That was used, like, people, I don't know when and where he gave it, but a lot of writers use that one. That's how he describes a wedge shot. Sashaying, a bird flying to the firmaments.
All right.
All right, where do we want to go next?
So, the Beeman blow-up. It happens in 84. At the New Orleans, then the USF and G Classic. O'Grady allegedly. It's very important to say allegedly, gets in an altercation with a female tournament volunteer where he allegedly calls her a bitch.
Yes.
So O'Grady is fined by Dean Beeman $1,000 originally. O'Grady is irate.
500.
No, no, it started as 1,000.
1,000? Okay.
O'Grady's irate. He's denying the claim. Beeman bumps it down to 500. And what happens, you know, the next event is the Bob Hope. And he gets deducted from his earning.
I don't think it was the next event.
Well,
I think it was next year.
No,
like
it was.
He objects to it. They fight about it. And then, like, Hope early next 85, like January, whatever it is, they just deduct $500 from his price.
And this is where the relationship just goes nuclear.
Yeah.
So because it just gets taken out of his earnings. He feels like he's been stolen from. He calls Beeman a thief with a capital T. Do you have the full quotes?
No, I just have that one. He compared him to Hitler at some point. Dean Beeman is a thief with a capital T. He said, you know, it's authoritarian. It's a violation of like freedom of speech, stuff like that. The point, I mean... The point is, like, this was like, it was a cheap fine of a dispute. Like, all he had to do was apologize to the volunteer, right?
Yeah.
When it started. And instead, it's like 1984 turns into like 2 or 3 years of just, you know, ends up in federal court. There's lawsuits. Like, he just, and it's all like, it goes back to a lot of it being like misidentified in that theft case. Like, he just had a chance to rebel against authority.
All right. I got the quotes right here. He said, okay. If anyone should be fined, if anyone should be fined, Dean Beeman should be fined for taking or garnishing the money out of my tournament earnings. Our problem is we happen to have a commissioner who runs the PGA Tour as if it is his totalitarian, authoritarian system. So then the tour was sending O'Grady notices of intent to punish him for some of his statements. They say he was in violation of Article 6 of the PGA Tour regulations. This rule, which O'Grady calls the gag rule, prohibits statements to reporters that are critical of officials, sponsors, or courses, which I believe is still in existence, the PGA Tour. Beeman said, the integrity of the PGA Tour and the game of golf itself have been attacked, and I cannot allow one individual to continue such destructive statements without taking serious action.
I mean, it just escalated from this allegation to $500, just apologize. But no, I mean, McCord talks about, like, Gary McCord, who's like really is one of his
best friends,
at least someone who seemed on the same wavelength a little bit. You know, he sued the tour. It was Mac versus authority, his favorite fight. That's his soup. He wants a father to defy. I think that's what happened with Dean. Someone in authority said, no, you can't do it. And Max said, watch me. So like $500, you know, they deduct it from his check. Could have been it. And it becomes like...
The thing, too.
He uses it to rip on Beeman, right? He's defying this gag rule of like, you know, you make the tour or its courses or your players look bad. You talk about them. You compare them to authoritarian regimes or a thief. That ad, you start, the fine becomes more than $500. It leads to $5,000, 6 week suspensions. I mean, at one point it's going to be, you know, 12 week suspension. Yeah. They thought it could get him for 3 months and $12,000 fine. It just was back and forth pissing me.
All the a lot of the players were behind him at the beginning of it because, you know, like they really thought it was wrong that they took the money out of his earnings. Like that pissed
like
a lot of
Crenshaw.
Yeah.
Some of these, like General Ben, mm-hmm. right? This gentleman that people respected. Was behind Mac. They just like, you're going about a little too aggressively, but yeah, we're behind.
And
you.
Then how long it ran on.
Right.
That's where, then they turned against him. Then they were like, what are you doing? You know? So he just continued to, it gets to federal court and so this is from, I think that New York, or the, this is from the Digest article. The scandal ended with a whimper. While dismissing O'Grady's lawsuit against Beeman and the tour, a federal judge scolded the plaintiff. Mr. O'Grady would better serve himself by polishing his clubs and his golfing skills and leave off his temptation for verbal engagements. In the end, O'Grady paid the $5,000 fine. It was a $5,000 fine, and he was on a year probation. And that's important.
In 5 weeks? How long was the suspension?
6 weeks.
6 weeks. Okay.
6 weeks. That was the year probation, because like people are like, oh, he's, you know, he's falling into line for.
Yeah.
And people think, oh, it's all good. They've mended fences. But that is not the case at all.
He behaves for his year of probation? Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
Or, I mean, at least he's not calling, you know, him authoritarian or anything. He also ripped Jim Colbert. Do you remember that?
Yes.
Like, flashback.
Well, Jim Colbert ripped him.
Oh, that's
so
right.
So I have it
that's
here.
Right. I had that.
Let me find it.
Colbert, he said Colbert's like... not as wealthy as he seems, or he's broke, and he makes bad golf courses or something like that in Las Vegas.
So Colbert said, I'm speaking for myself as a golfer and not a member of the policy board. I know it's very hard on for Mac during these times, but we golfers are not happy with the press we are getting. It's not good for any of us. All of us hope that Mac will straighten out soon. Personally, I disagree with what he says. I don't feel he should make personal attacks on the commissioner, who I feel is the best commissioner in any sport. Sounds like PGA Tour article.
There was some dissension there.
Yeah.
Like Peter Jacobson, it's like Dean's like out of line. Like not Beeman wasn't like, you know, loved by everybody.
Colbert might have been the Prince of Pontevedra then.
He took a run at Fincham too. You see O'Grady? It's like Fincham.
I didn't see
that. Pissed. Oh yeah. Because they were like taking some small town event at Sutton, Massachusetts, at like Pleasant Valley. It was like earlier, late 90s, something like that. And he goes, Fincham, he's like the little man, wants to make it a global tour kind of thing. They're cutting out. So Beeman wasn't the only target, the only commissioner that took shots.
The end of the Colbert quote's great. He says, we're all better off. I own 3 golf courses, including San Dimas Canyon, and a couple of homes. We've got something good going, and we'd like to keep it going. I don't think anyone benefits by what Mac is doing. It's like quintessential, don't rock the boat, because everything's going great for me.
Yeah. But again, the whole point is like, this is a minor thing that some at New Orleans that becomes like 3 years. He's in front of like 3-man policy boards, federal courts. He uses the year to just trash Beeman in every which way he can. And like... It
2 years.
On for
2 years.
Three.
Because at 86 RIV, it's still going on. 86 LA Open. This is, you know, 84 New Orleans is where it started. And he refuses to talk to reporters because of the Steve Wolf article. But like everybody's still talking about this Beeman thing. The Beeman thing is still the center of attention. It just follows him around everywhere. And this is where he goes incendiary on Riviera. his former home course, like where a lot of his early investors were members, his hometown event, he just goes.
He was a junior member for a second.
Goes
right?
Nuclear on Riviera.
Rick Riley article I have, you know, hottest player. He was talking about the tour was being way down, right? Like they just didn't have a lot of star power. Jack was on the way out or was out almost.
I got this from an LA Times article.
Okay. Okay. I have Rick Riley, 1986. You know, it just O'Grady may have something to say when he chose to speak, but most of the time he's publicly likening Beeman to Hitler and railing against the tour for giving too much money to charity and not enough for him. For good measure, Mack the Knife cut up historic Riviera, site of last week's LA Open, calling it, quote, a cheap public course and a good runway for LAX, all of which made you wonder if Mack wasn't starting to lose a bit of his luggage. Mack O'Grady says Johnny Miller is dial a shot. He can hit the ball as far as he wants. He can hit a six iron. He has the best swing I've ever seen on tour. I don't know why that bakes in. You got more Riviera quotes you want to throw out? Good runway?
Riviera is no longer the course it was when Hogan and Snead were romancing it, and it was one of the great courses. Since the Barranca is gone and the trees were neglected for years, and they have about 5,000 members, it's like a cheap public course. That's where it goes. Riviera was once great, really great, but today it would make a good runway for LAX.
On Riviera's greens, he said to at least Riley, like putting over a waffle iron. Do you have that in there?
He said
he did not like the greens.
He said in this LA Times one, he said it was like putting down a cobblestone road today. Might as well had walnuts in my line.
This is more anecdote, more stories from the Rick Riley. O'Grady doesn't make appearances in the press tent. He, quote, I do it to embarrass Beeman. He goes, on Beeman, he goes, I told Dean I'm going to rip you every chance I get. You think you're above the game? You think you're above the Bill of Rights? On the tour's top pros, I told them if I didn't start getting some support, I would start going after them. Let me tell you something about Jim Colbert. He owns all these golf courses, homes, and cars. Take a look at Colbert's record. He hasn't won enough to own all of those things. So basically saying he's a fraud. I don't want to say he's a crook, but there are some players with better records. It sounds like you do want to say he's a crook. Some players with better records who have won more money but still can't afford what he has. He's one of Dean's yes men. He's Dean's water boy. O'Grady even threatened to gas Brain 60 minutes in to investigate. In which they would be more than happy to do. Hello, I'm Andy Rudy. Don't you just hate it, one? That's Rick Riley writing. So, but the last thing on O'Grady, he played okay.
Yeah.
The last thing on his mind, the 86 LA Open, was winning the LA Open. Even though he led by one stroke after 36 holes. He goes, ever sweat a swing with a 250-pound chip on your shoulder. Besides, this is what O'Grady said. There are more important things to win. So, like... You know, he makes his pro debut deliberately at the LA Open. By 86, he's talking about how there are more important things to win after now, several year fight with Beeman.
I want everybody to remember all these LA Open comments that he made. Remember all the things he's done to trash the LA Open and Riviera, because it's going to be important in a future anecdote here.
Okay. All right.
He wins.
So 86, he finally wins. They're finally wins. Quote, he wins the Hartford Open. Greater Hartford Open. I think it was then the Sammy Davis Jr. Hartford Open.
Final,
right?
Final round, quote, 62 to win.
Shoots 62, comes back in a playoff, beats Roger Maltby in a playoff on Monday.
Do you have his quote?
There are times when you spread your wings and your molecules rise higher than they ever have before. And he won. That's his quote about winning the Hartford Open.
So horrible putter, right? Just an horrible, awful putter. In the playoff, he missed a 4-footer for birdie. And then Maltby
missed a
3-footer for par.
Yeah. That's his first win. Kind of amazing, right? It's Sunday 62.
The week before, he blew it, too. He finished...
Have
the quote?
No, Canadian Open, he blows it the week before, and I don't know, he writes a letter at 3 a.m. after losing at Canadian Open. He goes like, dear Mrs. Golf, I don't have the letter or the quotes from it. He's like, I don't know why am I why do I put up with you anymore? He's writing a letter to golf, Mrs. Golf. This gets back to the journaling, which we kind of read from Q School and all that. So, but he's, you know, really down, despondent after losing the Canadian Open and then wins with the 62, the next final round 62 at Hartford the next week.
So, yeah.
That's his first pro win. First of two.
Yeah.
And it comes during a year. I mean, you know, as Riley put it, he's one of the hottest players on tour. Yeah, the Dean Beeman stuff is just raging, and he's kind of a headliner.
So the next year, there's some controversy. He's returning as the defending champion, but he doesn't notify the tournament that he's going to come until...
This is Hartford.
Until
right?
Sunday. Hartford. The Sunday before. He doesn't... And at this point, they had these eight-player shootouts on Tuesdays for $10,000. And he's not included in the shootout, which it's kind of understandable because he didn't commit till Sunday, right? And he's irate about it. He's goes nuclear on the tournament director. So every defending champion is in the shootout everywhere on tour. I expected to be in it when I came here today on Tuesday. If I won the U.S. Open, are you telling me I couldn't play? O'Grady snapped at the former Greater Hartford Tournament chairman, Ted May Jr.
Unbelievable. He didn't commit until like 2 days before. Flipped out.
The best is that I found this article. I couldn't find the source article, but this longtime Hartford journalist wrote an article in, I think, 2017 about his favorite story. And his favorite story, he was retiring. His favorite story he ever wrote was the profile on Mac O'Grady. Like, he was just like spending time with Mac. It just talks about how he was the greatest champion ever of the Greater Hartford Open. And like forever, he will always follow Mac O'Grady with interest wherever he goes. You know, it's just like kind of like, you know, this guy was the ultimate, you know, like 1980s, 90s golf journalist catnip.
Right. Yeah, well, I mean, the quotes are just amazing. So you want to go to the second win?
Yeah.
Gets out of 86. 87, he wins the Tournament of Champions at La Costa.
One of the last thing about Beeman Fine, O'Grady would pay his caddies incredibly well.
Oh, yeah.
He would tip them $500. So, like, the amount of money he got fined originally amounted to a caddy's tip. And that was one thing. He paid his caddies extraordinarily well. He was super generous.
Yeah. In addition to never taking money for a lot of stuff, like teaching or not doing any endorsements. So, like, the money was not the priority. All right. So 1987 gets his second win early. The TOC, Tournament Champions, La Costa, shot 65, 72, whatever, 278. He edged Rick Fair by a shot and Greg Norman and Mal Calcavecchia by two to win the second tournament of his rapidly, this is Jaime Diaz, rapidly improving career. He cruised around La Costa's 6,900 layout with little more than a one iron and a wedge. So smoking the ball. But the shakiness of his left-handed putting stroke and the fear of heel prints on the rain-softened greens were so acute that he found an abundance of ways to convey his feelings. It was like having teeth pulled without Novocaine. I thought if I touched the ball, it was going to go off like a grenade. Fear is just rampaging through your imagination. My conscious mind was hemorrhaging. Those are his quotes about trying to putt left-handed and on the soft greens. His strong reaction to stimuli is elevated. Yeah, it explains in large measure his ill-advised and recently aborted lawsuit against Commissioner Dean Beeman. That we just went through all that. There's a quote, though, from Tom Kite in this. There isn't anyone out here who thinks he handled it properly. That's all, says Tom Kite about the demon.
Did you see the one that golf is like a sword? O'Grady, golf is like a sword. One moment it's crowning you king. The next moment it's lacerating you.
Yes. Yes.
He said that he contends all pros would admit to similar feelings if they were honest.
He said of the soft footing on the wet course was giving him an unpredictable launch frame. The resulting vestibular ocular response, he said, was causing him to bypass proprioception and to activate unwanted contractions in his distal muscles. Talk about panic anxiety, said O'Grady. If the ground stays soft, I'm dead. But this is where you get some of the praise. Like, you know, Crenshaw said, Mac's physical attributes are astounding. He has hit some of the greatest shots ever seen on the PGA Tour. Physically, O'Grady said, I feel like I'm still in junior high. So, I mean, he was a rookie at 31. He's now 87. He's 35. He's playing some of the better golf. But, like,
did you see the anecdote that he would sprint from shot to shot?
Yeah.
He would run from shot to shot.
Yeah. 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 Oh, here's the quote. You know, O'Grady says after the final round of the Canadian Open last year, at 3 a.m., I wrote a letter. It started, Dear Mrs. Golf, I hate you. Why do you continue to mutilate me with these merciless acts? I stopped crying and went at Hartford. So he also credits Seve after in this TOC article. In the nick of time, O'Grady applied a lesson from the great sage Seve Ballesteros, who, you know, Ballesteros relied on O'Grady's teaching too. I once asked Seve, what do you do when the atrocities start to eventuate? Seve said, there's only one answer to that, and it is very hard to understand. Not everybody can understand it. You just have to forget it. That's it. In other words, O'Grady's words, anterograde amnesia, forgetting something immediately. So that's from the Jaime Diaz. There was a New York Times write-up of this as well that I read, his win at the Tournament of Champions. He goes, quote, walking off the 12th, I needed to have anterograde amnesia, he said. That's quick forgetting. And the writer of the New York Times goes, actually, anterograde amnesia is the term sometimes used for short-lived loss of memory, such as the blackout of a few hours suffered by alcoholics.
Was that Gordon White?
Yes, yes. So that's a sort of kind of terminal velocity type correction in real time that the New York Times will actually do on the anterograde amnesia quote.
You know, something I found on this tournament was on Wednesday after he shoots the lower round, he shoots 65, he's tied for the lead with Cal Kvecchia. He says, he said, the course favors the long hitters like him. He said, all players except Greg Norman are pretenders at the $500,000 Tournament of Champions. Said, don't be surprised if Fred Astaire is doing the tap dance at the end of the picture. Greg Norman will get the girl at the end, I promise you. And then he wins.
Yeah. Said his own round possessed, quote, a special aura that takes over and illuminates. Sometimes you learn that the golf club moves you and not vice versa.
Did you say what happened, like the eighth and the ninth, like the sequence of events?
No, I mean, he had like a he had a multiple three putts, like just bleeding. I had the blow in here somewhere.
He started the day leading Rick Fair by one and Norman and Mahaffey by two. On the ninth, he missed a three footer that would have given him a three shot lead. And he three putted from 8 feet on the 10th. After he three putted from 14 feet on the 12th, he was tied with Cal Kvecchia and only a stroke ahead of Norman and Fair. And that's when he applied the Seve advice, the great sage advice from Seve.
Anterograde amnesia. That was it was the soft greens. I love that. He goes, I'm dead. It's like the putter is hitting a grenade every time it touches the ball. So the putter, I mean, this is the theme of his you know, entire career, right? He just can't putt. He can't putt for shit.
But he doesn't believe he's a bad putter.
I know.
That's the thing. He thinks he's a good putter. He thinks that this is like the lead of the story. He thinks that the footprints, like everybody's going through the same thing with the footprint. And this is where people talk about like his mental, like he's brilliant. I think there's a Fair quote here. He says, people think he's gone off the... There are quite a few players who feel Mac has gone off the deep end, said Fair. I don't. He's a brilliant guy, and it might be harder for him to play golf than someone who's not so bright. I know my mental images aren't as colorful as Max. I don't think anyone's are. So it's like that idea of like you either gotta be really dumb or really smart to play really good golf.
Right. I mean, even Kevin Cook, the Digest article, right? He calls them putts with the putter. I think Keller, like even in the early days, there was never a three footer that Phil Mugleno couldn't miss, kind of thing. It's just like, I don't know. He claims the whole left-handed thing was by design, and other people saw it as a crutch and just a bad one. What he talked about is he was activating both sides of his brain by putting left-handed. He goes, I use a different hemisphere of my brain. The right half controls your left side, and putting left-handed is better for someone whose right eye is dominant because your right eye looks down the line to the hole. If you put right-handed with dominant right eye, you'll line up three balls to the right of the hole. Did you see the quote about he's living in like a 10 dimension? He's 10D. Like, talk about, I mean, like your third.
I think one thing just about O'Grady, anywhere you go, you find a new story, new quote. Yeah. It's just unbelievable. Yeah. Like, this thing could be 3 hours long if we kept going down the rabbit hole.
My friend Raphael tells me that physicists look at the world in three dimensions, but I have 10 dimensions. He calls me 10D.
God, that's so like, that's like Bryson's third deviation.
I mean, that was like early. That was like 1983 he said that. So, all right, where should we go next? We got his two wins. Those are his wins, TOC and the Hartford.
Do you want to go to 88 where he gets off probation?
Yeah. Oh, one thing we should say, 1987 Olympics.
Yeah, oh, US right? Open. This is good.
Right? He's at the US Open and someone shouts, he's tied for the lead on the 15th hole. Is that right? Hey, Mac, you're tied for the lead. Mac O'Grady was winning the US Open. Final round charge to catch Tom Watson, Scott Simpson, Seve at Olympic. For about 1 minute, O'Grady was the hottest player in golf. Then a fan shouted the score. Mac, you're tied for the lead. He hesitated. And he started crying on the 15th tee, right? And blew it. I think that was T9.
Yeah, finished T9. He was T9. Leading to T9.
He started thinking about, I don't know what the explanation was. He started thinking about winning his national championship.
I've got a quote from an LA Times article. O'Grady almost retired in last year's Open at the Olympic. He was close to the lead with four holes to play, but finished tied for ninth, closing with three bogeys and a par. This is what O'Grady said. The problem was I started reciting my retirement speech. It's a good one, too.
Oh, God. All right, so that's 87. That was like his only even close call at a major, right? He played about like only 13 majors.
Yeah.
Three Masters, five PGAs. He had only one top 10. It was that T9 at the 87 US Open Olympic. Oh.
All right.
All right. Probation. He comes off probation.
So this is an LA Times article in 88. Thomas Bonk. The last time O'Grady and Beamon saw one another, it was the third day of the Players' Championship at Sawgrass, where O'Grady didn't make the cut and vowed never to play another Beamon-inspired TPC course again. When they passed within a foot of each other in the clubhouse, each looked the other way while the temperature dropped near freezing. So, this is O'Grady. On what's like his problem with Beamon. It's the first of two measures that should be administered, O'Grady said. The first one is square grooves. And what is the second measure? Should the players find a new commissioner? No comment. Should the players blow up all the TPC courses? No comment. Should the players start their own union and control it themselves? No comment. You get the idea. But O'Grady's real second measure is to ban metal-headed woods, too. Why? Square grooves and metal-headed woods have given rise to mediocrity. If you eliminate the metal woods and the square grooves, the rise in mediocrity will fall rapidly, and the little Davids, the little mosquito players who are slaying the giants, will soon vanish.
He You want to do Tiger? He took a shot at Tiger for that, right?
Well,
because he was playing with the grooves and metal woods. I mean, he kind of like said Tiger isn't Sam Snead, Tiger isn't Jack, Tiger isn't Arnold Palmer, because he didn't have to use woods and mostly equipment. The equipment angle was his reason.
He's not done in this article.
Yeah, go ahead. Continue. He's off probation. He's going nuts about equipment, TPC courses. No comment. While asking the questions are the comment, right? Should we blow up all the TPC courses? I mean, there's your comment.
So he's asked if he expects to hear from Beeman as a result of these new statements. He said, he'll do something. That's all right. If he says, I'm going to fine you $500, I'll just say, where do you want the check to go? It's so foolish. Blow up the TPC courses. Who'd believe that anyway? All right. So what's wrong with the TPC or stadium courses? Two things, O'Grady said. They were all thought of by Dean Beeman, and all the power hitters have no relationship with the courses. You need 30 clubs to play a TPC course, and one of those is a rifle.
Oh, so he finally gets off probation, immediately lays into Beeman. Indirectly, directly, maybe, but dances around it a little bit.
So his Tiger quotes.
Hit on him, right? Yeah. I mean, it's just kind of like he held them to a different standard, a lower standard because of the modern equipment. So I don't know if that's still the case. That may be inaccurate, but yeah, that was allegedly what he said. All right. He starts to really wash out because of the nerves, right? The putting, his back is just a mess.
He gets in a fight.
UCLA. Did you see the UCLA did a $30,000, he commissioned and paid for it, $30,000 study to figure out what's nerves and yips. And the results, which he published in the Journal of Neurology, or UCLA did, the yips are associated with three factors: advancing age, obsessional thinking, and how long the subjects had played golf. Thus, he was perfectly serious in saying, the nerve endings in my fingertips are misfiring. So, yeah, like that starts to be an issue. Like the putting just was never up to, as well as you hit the ball, it was never up to snuff. His back starts to go poor. What was the fight you're talking about? He gets into a fight?
He got in a fight after the second round of the TPC Initech Classic.
Really?
That's a Swamp Ass Invitational.
I missed that.
Okay. Walking off the 18th green, O'Grady was confronted by an angry Tom Stickney, whose 18-year-old son, Tommy, had caddied for O'Grady during Thursday's opening round. Father was upset about what he claimed was abusive behavior by O'Grady towards his son. O'Grady kept walking back towards the clubhouse while Stickney blocked his path. O'Grady shoved Stickney out of the way, and tempers erupted. Punches were thrown, and they ended up brawling on the ground.
It's not the only time there were alleged threats from physical violence.
Both sides agreed to drop the matter. O'Grady's caddy said that the claims that Stickney was making were false, so that Stickney's kid only caddied for him Thursday, didn't caddy anywhere after. O'Grady would be at Kemper Lakes next week for the PGA Championship. PGA Public Relations Director Sid Wilson said, not as a competitor. But that's because he didn't qualify.
All right. Anything else on his playing career?
I got stuff on his retirement.
He's forced to retire at 1990.
Well, the beta blockers.
From the spine disorder. Well, that's after his retirement, right? Isn't that 94?
I'm not sure where it is.
Forced to retire at 1990 from the spine disorder. He gained new fame as a school instructor. What did he do in his retirement? He goes, he was glad to be finished with golf's, quote, tin can bureaucrats and dumb, ignorant jockocracy. That was how he rode off into the sunset, 1990.
So this is right with there's a big investigation into his fight with the Stickney at the Swamp Ass.
Yeah, Memphis, yeah.
So Beamon writes him a 13-page letter, which, you know, is just doubting O'Grady's account of the incident in the Memphis. So O'Grady writes an aside to Beamon, and this is when he retires. He goes, he says, "Please, Dean, leave me alone. P.S. I've always wanted to tell you this. You bore me."
So just Beamon wrote him a 13-page letter?
Yes.
And Mac's response was, "Please leave me alone. P.S. I've always wanted to tell you this. You bore me." So he's no longer a playing member, but, you know, he's going to be around tour as sort of this, I don't know, iconoclast swing guru or master of the swing. So
this is from an Orlando Sentinel article.
Yeah.
"Frustrated by the capitalistic and corporate nature of golf and golfers, O'Grady 38 vowed he would never return to the fairways. Mac didn't volunteer to return the $1 million he earned on tour as a captive slave of Beamon's. Though, and this is O'Grady, you dream of being a pro athlete. I've lived that experience. I'm embarrassed to say that I'm being a jockocrat and a jockocracy.
Yeah. He used that a lot. I saw him in that Roy Firestone YouTube video. He used jockocracy. He retires in 90, but he comes back in 91, right? I mean, Monday qualifies for the LA Open.
Do you see his grandiose plans upon retirement?
No.
He says he has grandiose plans, including a universal players union and the development of an international world tour he hopes will put the you-know-what out of business. I'd go into detail about O'Grady's players making $10 million a week, juniors paying $50,000 a year for lessons, and Japanese forking out billions to hear his instructional tapes of swing mechanics and Zen life and martial arts discipline, but I'm not sure I understand it all myself." This is the writer of the Sentinel article.
91. He comes back. He Monday qualifies, right, for Riviera.
He's inspired.
Jaime Diaz earned it up. He goes, he's inspired to start playing again after watching 45-year-old Hale Irwin overcome a long slump to win the U.S. Open. O'Grady sought and received the sponsor's exemption to play an international in August. His back problems flared up again. He Mondays qualifies. He goes, his quote, "A lot of people may perceive me as being in the gutter because I'm playing in these qualifiers. If that's true, the gutter is still where water and dirt collect and where growth takes place." You have anything else on that 91 comeback?
He went for the sponsor's exemption, and he was like, he was just beyond disbelief that he didn't get awarded a sponsor exemption at the LA Open, which...
Yeah, so he didn't Monday into LA. It was something else, right? Maybe it was the Hope. So he didn't get a sponsor's to LA.
He Mondayed into the LA at another time. Let me see.
Yeah,
oh, here it is. "That rejection in particular has made..." So this rejection... This is from Diaz's article in New York Times. "That rejection in particular has made O'Grady wonder if his well-publicized feud with Dean Beamon, the PGA commissioner, could be coming back to haunt him, knocking on doors. I've got my skills, and people know I want to play. I've knocked on the doors in a lot of cases. I haven't received even the dignity of a return phone call." Like, maybe it was calling Riviera a good runway for LAX, or, you know,
waffle iron greens, and
feud with all these prominent Riviera members, which you like escalated into a nuclear war, you know, maybe this is the reason that you're not getting LA Open invites.
Couple other, should we do some miscellany controversies? I mean, there's the one.
Well, can we do a little bit more on his comeback?
Yeah, go ahead. What do you got?
This is his LA Times article. This is when he just started his comeback. There's a lot of great Thomas Bonk reporting with LA's hometown paper.
Bonk was the one that said he wanted to enter the BC Open, right? Is Mac O'Grady 1 and Mac O'Grady 2
so this
playing
is,
left
this
and right?
This is part of it. As soon as he discovered he had no pain swinging left-handed. He had all this pain righty with his spine. Yeah. But lefty, he was fine. And that's when he started his comeback. He soon discovered, however, it doesn't bother him when he swings left-handed. O'Grady plays left-handed almost as well as from the right side. He even tried the qualifying school left-handed once. He said he was even going to change his name to Mac O'Grady too. That would have only been to confuse Beeman. This is what he said to Bonk. But I've matured by being away from the game for almost 1 year. Away from the system, away from Beeman, and away from the voices inside my head that tell me I'm going to push, pull, or miss the putts. I'm going to start making putts because I'm going to stop listening to those voices inside my head. I'm just going to listen to the voice of silence and let my intuition guide me through every hurricane on the putting green. I've got to find the eye in that hurricane.
1 year away, matured. Did you see, speaking of that, like, seeking out the fight?
1 year away and away from Beeman.
Beeman and away from Beeman.
This is a guy that got compulsive about everything, and it was clear he was compulsive about Beeman.
Did you see the Letterman anecdote, too?
Yes.
The fight about Letterman with Letterman? I lost you there. Wi-Fi went a little poor.
Yes.
But, you know, O'Grady, this is, I think, Kevin Cook, the digest. O'Grady is simply at home when on the lonesome edge during his public life with Beeman. Mac went on David Letterman. Naively expecting their chat would be spontaneous, he was annoyed when a producer tried to prepare him and tell him what to say. The producer made the mistake of adding that Letterman dislikes physical contact. So that night, O'Grady kept patting and squeezing Letterman's leg to the host's clear discomfort. He's going at David freaking Letterman. Mac later bragged about it and how he'd psyched out David Letterman.
How about how this two-time PGA Tour winner is on David Letterman's show?
I lost you there.
I said, "What? How about this two-time PGA Tour winner being on Letterman at all?"
I know. It's unbelievable. All right, more controversy.
All right,
should you go to 1994. He's this is again.
I got one
Kevin
other
Cook.
Thing.
He's most.
I got one other thing.
What? Okay.
I got one other thing. So he's playing in this Utah University Hospital Open in 91.
Okay.
So he's playing as a righty. He started tinkering with a left-handed golf. It goes back into his left-handed thing.
Yep.
In 1988, he embarrassed some fellow pros in a shootout match, beating the likes of Seve, Fuzzy, and Tom Watson playing left-handed.
Holy crap. Wow.
I could do it right now, he claims. I don't quite have the same flexibility yet, but I'm getting closer. I need another year. At this point, he's playing a ton of golf left-handed, but when he'd play in pro tournaments, he'd play right-handed because he didn't have the flexibility left-handed to hit it as far as he wanted. So he's playing a practice round. He showed up late, missed the first few holes with the pro-am guys. He was going to play his way in, and he played the last two holes at Willow Creek left-handed to save his aching backs and hit shots that looked every bit as good as his right-hander shot. During this pro-am round, he carried a bag that contained 27 clubs, a full set of right and left-handed clubs.
Well, I mean, that's the anecdote from when he was young, right, McCord? Talking about he saw him up against a tree or something at the Rancho, and then there's no way you can get anywhere. And then, like, moments later, from 150 yards away, the ball lands on the green. He goes, I keep a left-handed club in my bag for that purpose. I knew that would happen someday.
All right, let's go to 94.
Right. 94. More Kevin Cook. O'Grady seems to be comfortable in the midst of warfare. He made news at the 94 Masters by announcing that, quote, at least seven of the top 30 players in the world used drugs. He said they took beta blockers to steady their nerves. Beta blockers are prescription blood pressure drugs that can act as tranquilizers. O'Grady has admitted to using them himself experimentally and said they once helped him beat Tom Watson in a match play event. this like really like, look, a lot of the tour guys abided him, you know, his comments often, even though they rubbed him. This pissed guys off. O'Grady's accusations became public. Norman, Floyd, other like immediately called for his ejection from the game. So that was very controversial. Do you have anything else on the beta blockers thing? I mean,
just, I saw
just
one
launching grenades.
I forgot which pro it was. There's only one pro. They said there's only one pro using drugs. It's Mac.
He told Beeman that Beeman's sense of honor demanded a formal inquiry into the beta blocker abuse. Your sense of honor demands an inquiry into the beta blocker abuse. Anything else on some of these other
97 U.S. Open qualifier?
I mean, God, we're 25 years into it. He's getting into fights at these, like, I think it was a local qualifier
at Borrego Springs. Incensed by what he deemed to be poor etiquette of playing partner Graham Reed, a part-time pro golfer, O'Grady challenged Reed to a fight. He challenged the wrong man. Reed, a San Diego lawyer, sent copies of a furious letter to the USGA and PGA Tour authorities, citing O'Grady's behavior.
Reed alleged O'Grady challenged him a fist fight on the 12th tee. According to Reed, O'Grady became enraged when Reed walked off the green while Kerry Johnston, the third member, friend of O'Grady's, was lining up a 2-foot putt. Walking off the green, O'Grady just goes berserk over this. O'Grady raced after Reed, accused him of trying to distract him. He goes, "I admit I made a mistake," says Reed, "but I think Kerry could have spoken for himself." O'Grady uttered the words, "I'll fight you on it. I'm a pretty reserved guy, but I know a lot of people would have flattened him right there." This is the lawyer saying that. Says O'Grady, "Started on the first hole when he didn't mark his ball when I was lining up a putt. Then he walked into my line of view for 2 holes in a row. Pulled the same stuff on Kerry. I couldn't take it anymore. I did get right in his face. But if there was a fight, the whole world would know. The guy would be dead. I mean, in the ground." O'Grady pauses before adding, "But I don't believe in physical violence. Under no circumstances would I threaten somebody on a golf course." So that's 97 sectional qualifiers. Reed says, "Unquestionably, it was my worst day of golf." And O'Grady, Max says, "They let guys in who don't know the game, and I'm a target. Anybody who knows me knows I'm a gentle guy and a traditionalist when it comes to golf." So 1997, still kind of making headlines for controversy. All right, where do you want to go? Teaching life?
One last thing of his playing career. He continued.
Okay.
He was the last player to use Persimmon Woods in a PGA Tour event, which we have talked about on this podcast before. He used them in the 04, 2004 BC Open on the PGA Tour. He used persimmon clubs in 2004. This is after the advent of the Pro V1. 2004, yep. He used persimmon clubs. In 2010, he used persimmon clubs in the Australian Senior Open and finished T5th. He used clubs from 1970 in the Australian Open, or Senior Open.
Unbelievable. I mean, we talked about the equipment with Tiger, right? And so there was a 2013 Michael Bamberger article. He's still like, O'Grady's still on the range, right? Teaching, he's still around. He was Humana, which was Palm Springs. He allegedly splits his time now between Palm Springs and Japan. I hear that he's over in Japan a lot with his wife. But Bamberger caught him there. He goes, in 1980s, he used a driver made of persimmon steel shaft, a lot of cover. He was considered one of the tour's beautiful swingers. Last week, he was at the Humana watching. Bubba Watson slash, O'Grady says, was born in his equipment. A graphite shaft, a driver with a massive titanium head, and a hard ball with a plastic cover. Quote, "If Bubba Watson had to play with the old equipment, he'd be caddying or shining shoes." The modern slashing swing offends O'Grady. Scott Stallings, maybe played the par four with the 18 with a driver 6-iron, made bogey to miss the playoff. That's not being in control of your golf ball. Control of your golf ball used to be what it was all about. And O'Grady's swing loyalties are to Sam Snead, a swinger if there ever was one. O'Grady's friend Ken Venturi had similar devotion to the way Nelson swung the club. So it's just this real sort of devotion to the old equipment, Snead, Nelson Venturi. And Bubba, apparently, like, I mean, come on. Bubba is like a completely unique character. He's an original, but yeah, he says it's all the equipment there. Shining shoes or caddying. All right. Should we dovetail into the teaching
sure.
a little bit?
Let's go.
Let's get this out of here. Knock this out.
Getting close to 2 hours here.
He's intense about it. Grant Waite was a subject of his.
Yeah.
But Waite, like, you know, he goes, understanding the swing and understanding how to play may be two different things. He's talking about how, you know, he didn't win a lot, right? He's a genius, but suspects he lacks a certain golf instincts. Whatever allows mojo allows Nicklaus or Tiger to forget all he knows of the swing mechanics and just hit it. You know, they would say Mac didn't have that. He knew everything about the swing, but he didn't have that. While Grady weighs 187,200 variables. He's incredibly territorial, as you can imagine, about his pupils, his swing thoughts, his swing theories, his competitors.
His Morad system.
I love that. The website is amazing. It's just like three paragraphs of text that doesn't lead you anywhere. It's probably put up there in 2001 and just hasn't been changed. But O'Grady temporarily cut off lifelong pal Gary McCord for speaking to David Frost because David Frost was a student of David Ledbetter, whom O'Grady mistrusted and accused of stealing his ideas. So he just, I mean, it was as sudden as a freeze as... It was a sudden a freeze as the time when past student Jody Mudd got cut off after he thanked Beeman on TV. Boom, gone. So even as pupils, like you need to, there's much more. You need to stay on the straight and narrow.
Yeah,
the Ledbetter thing.
You couldn't even talk
intense.
To people. Like the Frost story. The you know yeah. it's just unbelievable. There's all these guys who fell out of favor. He was the longest teacher of Seve, but then that even fell out of favor.
Ballesteros was frozen out for fraternizing with enemies. How bitter was the spat? Mac called Seve emotionally bankrupt and said he would never be good again. Quote, Seve is a collapsed star, a black hole. Kind of, so it's intense. Should we go ahead? You have anything else on the territorialness of it?
I mean,
the Ledbetter thing was particularly acute.
So, like, there were, like, extreme success stories, though. People would be like, spent one day on the range with him, and I've never swung better. You know, and a couple like star pupils, he apparently turned around Vijay Singh, which we didn't. I want to dive back in and see if that's in any of the spotlight research. Elkington was another one, obviously Seve.
Chip Beck.
Yeah, Chip Beck. I mean, so he had a ton of success.
Yeah. Another quote. You can't talk to a Ledbetter guy. You can't teach people he doesn't like or puts you on probation. You have to give back all the computer printouts of your swing and all the positions.
Yeah.
You can't say the word Morad or swing his way for 30 days if you know, you piss him off or run the wrong
He line. Eventually freezes out McCord, too.
Yeah. That's what I mean. That's because he was talking to David Frost. Some of the good stuff, a pro who fell under his spell watched one of O'Grady's favorite tricks. He dropped the ball on the sidewalk, pointed to a bathroom door 100 yards away, and hit a screaming three-wood through the door. Quote, and I mean through the door, says the pro, a veneer door, and he knocked a hole in it. He allegedly loves to, like, do running shots, right? He can do running, like, call cut, call fade. While he's on the run, you throw him a ball. He can do all. He's, like, an amazing, obvious talent, total control. This is McCord. I'd say Mac did really well for a guy who couldn't putt at all. He was never a great wedge player either. He was so powerful, he couldn't slow the club down. But for Mac, playing the game is not what's important. And this gets to the teaching aspect. His quest means more than trying to make five footers to go in. He's on an information siege. He wants to make the swing give up its secrets. And that's what he's trying to do, you know, continued to try to do as a instructor of sorts. Digest, like, recently, they had to, like, withhold, like, the names of his current disciples to protect their access to Mac because he doesn't want any media coverage of any kind. Some guys watch through bootleg videos. You know, this Morad project is, like, decades old.
It's part of his book, The Golfing Prophet.
Digest stopped ranking him because we couldn't verify whether he gives lessons anymore. He was long ranked him on the top, whatever. Yeah, but they describe him as a cross between Ben Hogan and Bobby Fischer.
You know what? I was texting with Shackelford, and he said that he took a couple lessons from Mac back in the day.
Wow. In the 80s, seven of the world's top 25 players were his disciples in the 80s. So he abhors self-promotion, preferring a pure pursuit of golf perfection. So he just spends like, I think it's that over $150,000 on his own money on this Morad project, which is still, you know, it's to crack the game's code. But, you know, still waiting on that.
I had an article with all of his books pulled up, but now I don't have them.
He rates every swing on like 100 on a scale of 100. Like Davis Love III gets about a 92 on his scale. Macolites, as they call some of his disciples, were like higher. You know, Sam Snead's swing, they said, was a near perfect 99 on O'Grady's scale. The two questions that remain of Morad, locked away where only the highly suspicious and controlling Grady has the answers. Will it ever be published? And if so, will anyone be able to understand it? Oh. I mean,
all right.
Go ahead.
I found this. All right. So he's been in retirement. This is a Hartford Current. This is when Mac O'Grady returns to play the 91 Hartford Open.
Yeah.
I've just got to read the lead here. During the writing of it, Henry P.P. Farnsworth horned in on one of Mac O'Grady's recently completed books. He grabbed the typewriter out of Mac's lap and put it in his own and started writing. And when he had finished the last nine chapters of The Golfing Prophet, he had taken O'Grady apart, blasted him. He tells me off, tells me how irresponsible I've been, just hammers me, O'Grady says. The 1986 GHO champion is back in Cromwell again, and HPP Farnsworth is with him. The fact is, HPP Farnsworth is him. He is O'Grady's alter ego, the other Mac, which is absolutely in character. All of the unusual, complex things that couldn't be contained in merely one man.
That's HPP Farnsworth?
HPP.
Is Farnsworth or Farnsworth?
Farnsworth. Let me find. He goes into the Farnsworth is what?
The alter ego. Kind of unbelievable. Should I give a little bit more on Morad?
Yeah.
Real quick? You want to get,
I got more. I got a little bit more on Farnsworth.
Okay, go ahead.
So Farnsworth is Henry Philosopher Prophet Farnsworth. They split their time between Japan and Palm Springs. Him, Fumiko, and Philosopher Prophet Farnsworth.
So Morad is his life work. He probably doesn't even care they won twice on tour. Like, there was emotional achievement to that. It's incredibly complex. The model features 10 segments or ideal positions from address through follow-through. Each segment has 10 subsections, each of which has a proper position for 13 body parts. Specified in 3 dimensions, that means 3,900 variables per swing. And you'll find more refinements in O'Grady's sheaves of charts. Every variable optimized for each club, for hooks, draws, fades, and slices, high, low, and medium trajectories. The model contains precisely 187,200 variables, and quote, Mac knows them all, says a doctor familiar with his work. This is still ongoing. Morad's never been published. We know there are, I mean, he blames like a little bit of the back trouble of like sitting and writing a lot of this, writing this 5-work tome.
He's got 5 books. He said will be published in Tokyo. This is in 91. The Golfing Prophet is his favorite of the 5 books. The others are called The Neuroscience of the Golf Swing, The Biomechanical Template, the evolution of the golf swing in the 20th century that studies the swings of 30 top players, including Arnold Palmer, Jack Nicklaus, Lee Trevino, and Gary Player, and the evolution of tournament gurus. The last asks the question, who are golf's gurus and where do they come from? The last 155 pages are a critique of David Ledbetter, known as the Golf Tour's golfing guru.
He hates Ledbetter. Hates him. Accuses him of stealing. If you even talk to him, you're out. He's not a fan of Ledbetter.
O'Grady writes the first half of his book. Fansworth writes the second half.
Oh, my God.
But all around, this is an uplifting book, a story about the miracle of being alive.
On a serious note, like a contemporary says, I believe Mac understands what happens during a golf swing as well as anyone ever on earth. He is never satisfied. He is always refining the model. But at some point, you get to understand, I don't know, what's the best way to convey all that.
I can't remember where I read this. It was something about like how the books haven't been published or and will they ever be? And one player goes, here's the thing, like, nobody edits Mac O'Grady. That's the thing we know. Right. Nobody edits it. And so, you know, at this point, the books will never be published because, like, nobody's going to edit them.
Right, right. All right. You got anything else you definitely want to get off? I mean, like we said, it could have been 3 hours. We almost went 3 hours, it feels like. There's just so much there. He's a unique, original, like, you know, historic character in golf. He's not a Hall of Famer. He's not, you know, Ernie Els or Mark O'Meara or any of these other past spotlights. He's not Frank Stranahan, even in terms of success. I mean, I think we had a pretty clear argument for Stranahan's inclusion in the Hall of Fame. But why did you feel so compelled to, why did we do this? Why Mac O'Grady? I think, like, for us, we're in our 30s. We're familiar with the name. We didn't know all the stories. We know he's like this golfing machine, golf sort of trying to understand the science of the swing, but didn't know a lot. Knew there was like Beeb and Tussles, but he was a little before our time. I guess I just try to always, while I was researching, try to conceptualize who or what, how this could happen now, right? In our current moment, who would do this? Who could call the commissioner
little Hitler?
Yeah, yeah. Like, I was trying to think of that, how this could happen nowadays. But, I mean, it was fascinating to look back in the history of this character who came from, you know, storage box and a rough upbringing to being, you know, hailed as one of the, hitting some of the greatest shots PGA Tour's ever seen. So, anything else?
Nothing else.
Nothing legacy? Do we want to talk about legacy? It's still being written, I suppose.
It's not over yet. Who knows when Mac O'Grady's going to reemerge? I mean, all-time character.
That's the thing. Like, it's a character that you tell the story of golf. You have to, whether it's the swing, whether it's the tour, whether it's Q School, of course, the 17 tries. I think he's a part of the story of golf and a name, you know, that will live on in the annals of the game for that character.
I've never seen so many articles written about a man that won two events and played on tour for 5 years.
Or a two-hour podcast probably is not going to happen on a guy that's won two events.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Who knows? Maybe a podcast interview like will come from this. Somebody will go hunt him down.
Yeah. It doesn't sound like he's eager to talk to anybody, and it's very hard to find. It sounds like the most recent thing I found was like his wife answers the phone, and maybe you'll get through, or maybe you never will. I don't know. If you can,
I want to go take a golf lesson from him.
That'd be cool. I wish we need another Mac O'Grady to come along, but I don't think there ever will be one.
I don't think anybody will. I think a lot of the things he typified with the tour about the way that speaking out, like, it's even worse. Nobody says anything now.
Yeah. Yeah. You have like Koepka, maybe, to a certain degree, but that's usually at other people. I don't know. It's there's not a lot of rebellious streaks on the tour. So. All right. This lengthy spotlight on Mac O'Grady is brought to you by Ruckit, The URL is ruckit.com/shotgunstart. We'll be back with a more typical show on Wednesday. Everyone enjoy your Mondays, and talk to you soon.